Hello, this is Daryl Armstrong, the producer of the 88 Names podcast. I'd like to welcome you all to a very special final episode. When my friend Blake Collier approached me in late 2019 about putting together some sort of promotional campaign for Matt Ruff's new novel 88 Names, I agreed immediately. We decided to launch a podcast interviewing various real-world people involved in VR development. It would serve to promote Ruff's book and give these artists, technologists, game developers, and engineers a platform to talk about their work. We wound up booking an incredible lineup of guests and partnering with some amazing sponsors. My work on this led directly and indirectly to a large portion of what took up my professional time and even hobbies over this last year in quarantine. And now, as we draw the 88 Names podcast to a close after two seasons, I'd like to share my appreciation for some of the people who helped make this happen. Thanks to my business partner, Kristalina Houston, and Shahab Zargari, who hosts our website. Thank you to our amazing sponsors, Derooted Immersive, Drew Stone at Locusium, HyperX, and GC Records. Thanks to all the amazing guests and contributors. And of course, thanks to Blake and Matt for letting me organize this little circus. I've learned so much about VR technology and immersive spaces over the last year and a half. Here now are Blake and Matt wrapping up our experiment and sharing some of their thoughts and reflections. Enjoy.
Derooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names podcast. Derooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at Derooted.com.
Welcome to 88 Names with your hosts, Blake Collier and Matt Ruff. We are ending this beautiful podcast with a kind of freewheeling conversation between Matt and I. A friend of mine, Demetrius Sanders, asked me personally if we were going to do a kind of a wrap-up episode with just Matt and I talking about the things we've learned and the friends we've made along the way. And so we decided, well, might as well end it off, you know, kind of just the two of us talking about what we've learned and, you know, some of the fascinating things that we've kind of dug into on this podcast. And, you know, anything else that we tangent into is great too. So, yeah, this should be a pretty loose episode. So we'll see where it goes.
So, yes. And I just to open with a bit of housekeeping, we have a new sponsor. And at the end of the day, this is the HyperX Quadcast microphone, which I am currently using. So if my voice sounds extra good on this episode, or if I say anything incredibly intelligent, this is why. It is a high-end gamer's microphone, comes with a really cool stand, shock mount if you prefer to hang your microphone above you. It's got four different pickup settings, including stereo. So if I wanted to dance around the microphone, you could actually hear my voice traveling from left to right and back again. I'm not going to do that, but I could. And of course, the other thing, which unfortunately this is audio only, but it is an incredibly sexy looking microphone that glows bright red. And there's apparently an even more advanced model that you can actually control the colors that it glows. Oh, wow. But that's more power than I can handle. But what is important about this is that, yes, it basically is a big warning that this sensitive microphone, if you're going to make an embarrassing noise or blurt out a confession, it's warning you that it will pick it up. But it's also got this cool feature where you can just touch the top of it and the light will go out and you can, you know, blurt out your confession safely and then bring it back online. So so the HyperX Quadcast microphone, available wherever sexy glowing microphones are sold.
That was a beautiful ad. I think they're going to appreciate that. So
I hope so.
I mean, I would like to see if they've had anyone else talk about the glowing, sexy microphone that it is. So
actually, I did look online at some reviews and everybody talks about how cool it looks. It's definitely awesome. Like, yeah. So, and I mean, this is a company that makes a whole line of gamer tuned gear. Like they have keyboards that light up and mice that light up and stuff. So it's that you can all coordinate these color changes with their software. So it's obviously, you know, we're not doing professional gaming here, but it's kind of in our ambit anyway. And I did do this live D&D session over the past couple of weeks where I got to use this. So I felt right at home.
Well, did you listen back to the recordings to see how good they sounded?
Yes. And yeah. It's a good mic. So sweet. I was happy with it. My hosts were happy with it. And
awesome.
So thank you, HyperX.
Yeah. We salute you. So I suppose I don't know if we've really talked about this aspect of the podcast, but how it kind of became a podcast was because I approached you originally. I guess it was 2018. That seems right. I'll go with it. Was it 2017? It was one or the other.
You interviewed me about Lovecraft Country.
Yes.
And that's how we got to know each other. And then, yeah, you were just really interested to do something.
Something extra.
With this book. Yeah. Something extra special. And I have learned to say yes to cool suggestions like that when they, as you know, unless the person they're coming from seems crazy to me and I knew mm-hmm. you. So I was like, sure.
Yeah. Might as well. And then actually it was Daryl, our producer, that came up with the idea of the actual podcast itself. And we kind of ran with it.
And God bless you, Daryl.
Yeah, really, no kidding. He is.
Daryl is the hero behind the scenes here. Oh, he's been no working kidding. His butt off, and he's been in Las Vegas, which of course is one of the places you really want to be during a pandemic, yes. Especially with the casinos open. It's just, it's his delight.
It's like one big super spreader event. Yeah. So we kind of got this idea, and then, well, Daryl, being the ad guy he is, he was like, well, let's see what we can do with this. Like, can we get, you know, advertisers on board? Can we talk to Matt's publisher, HarperCollins? And then we just went a lot of different routes to see what we could kind of get our grip on. And 88 Names is kind of what we landed with. And the first season was really more of a experiment in a lot of things. We didn't realize it at the time when we started it that we were going to be releasing a lot of this actual content during a pandemic, and that Matt would pretty much be taking his whole book tour online. So
yeah, that was what was funny is that, yeah, we recorded most of the episodes when, you know, COVID was still a gleam in God's eye. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was one episode with where we briefly mentioned it, but it was still something that was just over the horizon, looking like it might become an issue. And then a week before my book was due to come out, you know, there's this weird report of an outbreak of COVID at a nursing home about 20 miles from my house. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then there was that period of denial that the whole country went through. Yes. Where everybody was like, well, we may have to make some adjustments here, but, you know, I thought I was going to be able to pick and choose the what events I could jettison from my book tour and what not. And then it very quickly became clear, no, we're not going to be doing anything around other people. Mm-hmm. But then there was this next period of denial. We were like, well, this is going to take a month or two to blow over. So I guess we're just going to have to go with it. So it was great that we had this podcast ready to go. Mm-hmm. And while all the other authors at HarperCollins were panicking and trying to figure out how to promote their books, I was already felt like I was set. And I, you know, because the book is about VR, I had some other online things in the pipeline. So I was a little ahead of the curve for once, but so that was nice. And it also helped because it brought a lot of this technology to the forefront so that other people were learning to do it. So it became very useful, mm-hmm. particularly later in the year as this dragged on further, just to know how to do all that. So it became a real learning experience. But yeah, it was a real experiment the first time around.
I just
felt so fortunate that we had this, because at least I had something to go with. And it was a great experience to do it. It was a lot of fun talking to these folks. And you and I talked about this. Neither of us, we're both introverts. We're like the least likely people that you would want to do a podcast, but it ended up being a lot of fun, and I'm glad we did it.
It's one thing I've learned over the years of doing podcasts, and I've podcasted probably at least 6, 7, 8 years total. And so I've never grown accustomed to listening to my own voice. And that's part of the reason why I hate producing podcasts, because that means I actually have to listen back and cut out my ums and my oohs and my, you know, cackles and any of my lip smacks or anything like that. So once again, thank you, Daryl, for taking on the actual work that I hate.
Thank you,
Daryl. Yeah. So I seem to remember, like, there's a couple of things that there's a question I'd like to ask you. Not the question, not the big question I was going to ask you, but kind of one that okay. popped up as we were talking just now. So I listened to at this point when we're recording this, you have been on Luke T. Harrington's podcast, Change My Mind. And you mentioned the fact that your agent was the wife of Thomas Pynchon.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm curious, what does she like? How much of this kind of whole world of campaigning your book and all and this podcast and stuff, like, what was her take on all this?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if Melanie's actually listened to the podcast.
Or
I've talked to her about doing it, and like, she's very excited, obviously, that we've, you know, got something going on. But this, like, she of course had to stay out of her own office for most of last year, so because she's there in New York, which is again a great place to be during a pandemic. This is really more of the kind of do-it-yourself stuff that a lot of authors end up doing. I think Melanie was more involved in, I mean, this was the other big thing last year, of course, is my novel Lovecraft Country get made into an HBO series. Mm-hmm. So
tenfold.
And here's the big takeaway from that is that if you want a really good advertising campaign for your book, have HBO make a series out of it.
Exactly.
Best selling tool you could come up with. With stuff like that, Melanie is a bit more hands-on about, you know, what I should be doing and what makes sense. But for this, I think she's not a big online VR gal. Okay. If we were doing an opera, I think she'd be there for that. But
I mean, anyone
think this is her bag.
Yeah, anyone who's married to Thomas Pynchon is probably not terribly online. That's interesting. I was just curious if she'd given you any feedback or if she was kind of.
Melanie's great. If I ever need her advice about whether to do something, she's wonderful for that. But
that's awesome.
She's not, you know, she doesn't with stuff like this. Like,
that's
we've been
cool.
working together long enough that she knows she doesn't have to micromanage me or warn me not to do stupid things anymore. So
that's awesome. Yeah. One of the things that we were in the early days of the podcast before when we were trying to get it figured out and like the schematics of what it was going to look like, we were coming up with guest lists, people that kind of anyone from, you know, Cory Doctorow was a big name that we were actually able to get. But also, you know, I even had David Cronenberg on there because I thought the idea of, you know, flesh and
awesome
kind of embodiment and things like that. So I actually did reach out to him, never heard back, but, David Cronenberg, if you're ever interested and you want to hit us up, we would do a special episode.
Special revived episode just for you. Absolutely. And I'm sure he's listening to this.
Oh, of course. He just finds random podcasts to listen to. But do you remember some of the other names? I was struggling to come up with, and I don't think I have the list anymore. So.
Oh, yeah. I was looking at it today, actually. I have to say that. You mean the list of people we wanted
the
or the people we got?
Yeah. Well, the list of people we wanted. But I mean, we got some really great and some really surprising guests, too, as far as the knowledge.
I mean, I'm sure William Gibson was on the list as well.
Yes.
And I'm totally not surprised we didn't hear back from him either. Probably anybody who's done anything remotely interesting in science fiction or film to do with this, we probably at least thought about reaching out to. But
we even got, I think I sent an email out to Michael Mattery's partner in crime in writing the ethics of VR, AR, but he, Metzinger, Thomas Metzinger.
Oh, is. Am I thinking the same? Is this the guy who got a Unabomber package, or no? Is that a different?
Oh, I don't know, but that would be
probably
a
not
really good story.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's another guy whose name is somewhat similar to that.
Yeah. It's what I read up on him. I didn't see anything about that. So, but yeah, I had sent
I'm
an email
thinking of
to
a
him.
Guy who wrote a book called Mirror Worlds. And now I'm just going to look this up very quickly that watch, his name's not going to be anything like anything like that, but I just do David Gallertner. Okay. Gallertner. So never mind.
Okay.
No, not much like it at all, except that it has syllables, multiple syllables. But well,
Metzinger, Gallertner.
Yeah,
I mean, kind of a tie there. Yeah, so there's a lot of names that we had on the list that I mean, at this point, I had never really done anything like this, so I was basically just trying to form a an email that sounded professional and that would find any kind of interest to grab them to bring them on the show, and we were able to get a really good roster of people the first season, and then whenever your paperback version came out this year, we were like, well, why don't we just do another round? You know, it was going to be a shorter season because we didn't know if we were going to have the time and the inclination with, you know, nearly a year into COVID.
I'm still thinking about that, but I was today getting ready for this. I just went back and read our wrap up essays from last season. Mm-hmm. And even there's still this idea that this is somehow going to be over soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I'm struggling to remember when it finally came to terms with the fact that, no, this is really going to go a year or more before it starts to end. Mm-hmm. And even now I'm trying not to get too excited. Like, my wife's had her first vaccine shot. I'm hoping to get mine sometime next week, but you know, there's this horror show going on in Brazil right now with the new variants.
Yes.
And I really hope it's over soon, but I just, I don't know. And then, you know, all of that feeding in to the election season, which made everyone extra cheerful. But I'm glad we got to do this again and just to come back and chat a little bit more about it. But it felt smoother this time because we both knew what to expect. And, but in terms of getting guests, because I've been on the receiving end of this year too, with particularly when Lovecraft Country was airing, of a lot of it is just luck and catching somebody with a request at the right time, because I have in my unanswered emails, I still got probably two or three requests that just came in when I was way too busy. And I was like, oh, I'll get back to you eventually, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, that was 3 months ago. Wait a minute. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, you just gotta, yeah, you send a professional email or a professional request and hope they read it at the right moment. Mm-hmm.
And if they're in the right mood, they've had their morning coffee.
Yeah. But I mean, the technology has certainly made it much easier to say yes to things like this, because I mean, this is one of my big takeaways was just, I love being able to do events, not in person, but just skip the whole needing to travel across country or even across the city. It makes a huge difference to just, I'll put clothes on for an hour and make sure my microphone is plugged in properly and everything. And, you know, make sure there's nothing embarrassing behind me on the Zoom screen, and then I can chat. And that's much, much simpler than, anything involving travel, especially out of state. So,
there's an element of not saying anything like, you know, the pandemic being a positive, because nothing about the pandemic was a positive, but one aspect of it for you and I being introverts is that our batteries are over fully charged. If you're anything like me, like, you're actually looking forward to having a little bit more people time because you're so energized.
Or just being alone in a different location.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, just going to, because I, as a writer, I need the perfect amount of distraction. So coffee shops are perfect for me, because it's not super loud, it's not super busy, but there's enough going on to where I can kind of, it keeps my brain working. So the idea of going back to coffee shops is just like, it's the height for me. I don't need to talk to anyone, but I just want to sit there and I want to type. That's all I want to do.
I just want to travel a little bit again, see some different things. I've got it was funny. Right, another thing that happened right before the pandemic hit, I got this interesting request from a travel magazine, which for all I know by now could be defunct, but it was a pretty big one associated with the Economist. And they were like, oh, you know, we'd love to underwrite some kind of spectacular trip if there's some cool place that you've always wanted to visit and write about. And I was like, huh.
And I
had some ideas, but it was like, it was one of those things where when am I going to have time with the other stuff I've got to do? And I regret that. I mean, even if I had said yes right away, there wouldn't have been time because this was probably a month before the lockdown happened. But
yeah. And you definitely didn't want to be stuck in another place.
No, so. I may hit them up though once this is over and say, hey, are you still interested?
Yeah, no kidding.
Here's my bucket list of places I would like to visit now that I can.
Well, and to get to write about it too. I mean, I've always wanted to write about place, you know, just the idea of like not about necessarily about people or philosophical ideas, but like just what is it to be in this space and what does that speak to me? You know, that's always a compelling thing. And I'm not sure I could actually pull it off because it's just not my style of writing. So
do you have a specific location you were thinking of? Or?
I mean, I'm all about the weird places. I like, you know, middle of nowhere. One of my favorite cities is actually Cheyenne, Wyoming. Super clean, super, you know, nice. It's got, you know, mountains, but it's also got, you know, you can drive 30 miles, I think it's 40 miles west, and get to a pretty nice university town, Laramie. And it's just a lot of cool scenery. I'm a big scenery guy. So
I am too. I like bleak landscapes.
Yeah,
like
same here.
Deserts. Same. And yeah. I like extremes too. So I remember in the 1980s going to a travel agent trying to figure out whether it was possible to get to Greenland. And this was before, the internet. So even an established travel agent, they were like, you know, I've never had anyone ask for a location that I can't answer definitively that question. I don't think I can sell you a ticket to that from here. You might have to travel to Iceland first and then ask them to buy you a ticket to Greenland. And yeah. And the other one is Ushuaia on the southern tip of South America. I just always kind of, you know, I'm not going to make it to Antarctica, but that's about as close as you get. And there's just something about that.
I mean,
and it takes 3 days to get that far south because you've got there's no direct flights.
Does it take boats?
No boats, but it's like you've got to fly to one capital and then to a smaller regional airport and then finally the last. So the biggest hop is the first one, crossing the equator and getting down to either somewhere in Brazil or somewhere in Chile or Argentina. But
that makes sense.
Yeah,
man. Yeah, you and me both. I would be right there. There's a lot of places there on my list. I'd like to go see the Eastern Bloc. Before it gets too modernized, but yeah, I've got a list and my wife does too. And so we're trying to figure out ways to make those happen before, you know, we die. So yeah, you should definitely hit that magazine up and see if you can pull that off.
Well, now you've got the new baby, which will make even more exciting. That's what you've been up to.
It is. Yeah. That's been kind of the other thing about, especially the second round of interviews. And I mean, going into nearly a full year of COVID and then having a child in December 1st and experiencing parenthood for the first time during the last few months has been a wild ride. And then on top of that, you know, doing podcasts and writing, although admittedly less writing I had been the last few years. So, but it's been nice. I mean, I've enjoyed every minute of it. It's just been crazy. And it's going to be a fun story for him whenever he gets older. Yeah, you were conceived and born in a pandemic. So...
But I think the timing will work out better for you. The folks I really feel, you know, for right now are folks with toddlers. And part of it is nobody really knows what this is going to do to their development to be isolated from other kids. And, you know, at least your baby will be, you know,
able to kind of function.
Isn't old enough to notice that. yet.
Well, my wife being a social worker, these are a lot of the big questions of like education and family life, because whenever you're stuck in a house, like her work increases, because when families are stuck together, they get unhappy. So it creates a fun little task for her, and it's been wild for her during this pandemic as well. So, but I think kind of being a strange context in which to do discussions about VR and AR has been opening up my eyes to the potentials of tech, because I'm kind of the tech skeptical guy on this.
You're anticipating podcast. My big question for you.
Oh, yes. and so part of it has been really moved by some of our guests' ideas about how this technology, while not perfect and while still being developed, has real like tangible potential to bring people together. And I think anything that does that is, on the surface at least, you know, a good possibility. It has good potential, or good bones, as some might say. And so seeing the fact that we've pretty much done this whole podcast through technology, I've never actually met Matt, but through Twitter, through Zoom, through Skype, all these technologies we've had to use, we've come together and pulled off this, you know, podcast and had all these guests and things like that. And then Daryl, who I also have not met, lives in Las Vegas.
But we're all friends now.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it's been wild to see how we're basically using what we're talking about to kind of get this out there. So
what's really funny with Daryl, I've only seen Daryl on video in like a month and a half ago the first time. It's been voice only with Daryl, so it's even more remote. At least with you, I've talked over Zoom. Mm-hmm. So I have a sense of what you look like. But it's like the first time I saw Daryl, I've seen him once on video, I think. I was like, oh my gosh, there you are.
So that's the face with the voice.
I think the only time before that was in Allspace VR when we were these avatars. So of course that is just a very surreal experience.
Oh, and, no kidding.
But I should, one shout out I wanted to give to you, because if people are interested in more of the kind of stuff we talk about on the podcast, we should probably mention, like, one of the guests who left the biggest impression on me was Noah Nelson, who runs Make Proscenium. It's a website and a podcast about all things immersive. And so, and I was listening to them a little bit this week as well. They're doing their, end of pandemic year wrap up and talking about the tech and how, like, they don't just deal in VR, they deal in things like interactive theater, which of course you can't do during this, and the ways that the more hands-on immersive arts have tried to adapt to having used technology like Zoom. So it's just a really fascinating discussion. And also, if you want to play with some of the stuff we've talked about or stuff that we've only alluded to, that's he's got a great list of things that you can get into. And it's funny, when I first discovered that, I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to spend some of my free time to really start poking into these things. And it's funny though, I just got distracted. It's like if I was doing more important stuff, then I would procrastinate by messing around with this stuff. But because I was, it's just weird. So
yeah, I'm same way. Yeah. I was really impressed with Noah's interview. He was kind of the first time that I realized that this could be a really human endeavor, AR VR technology. Matter of fact, I would say between him and the dungeon dudes, I found myself being really moved by a lot of their kind of insight into the idea of being immersive with technology and things like that. And so I some of my hardened heart was softened over the podcast. So and part of it's just because I am generally speaking not good at new technology. If it's anything past PlayStation 4, I probably have no idea how to use it. So
Well, it's funny. That was one of the discussions, I think, in one of the podcasts that Noah did this week that I was listening to. It was like, yeah, that this has been an issue that they have to, if you're going to do, you know, immersive tech or immersive theater online, part of the thing you have to get used to is that you're going to be dealing with people who are still trying to figure out, you know, how do I make this work? Mm-hmm. And it's really a whole process of introducing people to the technology that they're new at and making it a good experience. I think one of our other guests was saying, yeah, it's like that first time you use it, that's going to shape your attitude towards it. So you definitely want to get that right the first time.
From business needs to social events, an increasing amount of connection is happening online in immersive virtual spaces. Navigating these unfamiliar platforms and technologies can seem daunting. Locusium is here to help. Locusium understands, guides, and informs your project so you can spend time connecting with your community and teams. Unlock more possibilities for connection through virtual events with Locusium. Visit locusium.com to learn more.
Yes, and the Dungeon Dudes, which the other thing about that, of course, it was great. So I went on their show twice and we played a extended D&D adventure. I had not played live D&D since college. I played a lot of online role-playing games, but what was great about doing this with them was it just reminded me what a different type of game live D&D is than, because it's really interactive storytelling, which is, it's this one game type you can't do with an AI dungeon master. You need someone who understands what's happening and can adapt on the fly and sort of help you tell this cool story that you're trying to tell. And that was a lot of fun. And I mean, you know, Monty Martin, who's the DM on that, is just, he was just amazingly good at taking our wacky ideas and rolling with them. And Kelly McLaughlin and Joe, who was there as well, they were great playing off my wacky Mr. Big Thief character. So, but yeah, it's like contrasting that with an online game like World of Warcraft, which is wonderful in its own way, but that is much more about, yeah, it's a number crunching. You know, that the interaction is all about fighting and killing and it stuff that you don't need an intelligent referee to manage for you. It's like all about, oh no, if you use this spell, it's got this percentage chance to hit and we'll do this many hit points. And you've got to, you know, and this is the rotation of actions you've got to do to maximize your damage output. And it's that totally speaks to me too, my obsessive compulsive side, but it's a completely different game, really, even though it's ostensibly, it's got the same genre name, it's not the same thing at all. So yeah, that was a really eye-opening thing too. It's just, I had heard about other people playing board games on Zoom and my eyes would just be like, oh, really? But doing that made me realize, oh yeah, it's actually kind of fun to mess around with people, particularly if you're doing something that you cannot automate. So
well, and wasn't it Mike Pondsmith that was talking about doing some Zoom online gaming as well? And
oh, yeah.
how it would last for a while and then everyone would be like, meh, I think I'm done.
No, but they're the Dungeon Dudes guys, they've got it together. That was a lot of fun. So if people have not seen that, they you can look up on their Twitch channel. It's Dungeon_Dudes. And they have a YouTube channel where they have recordings of my two episodes and a bunch of others besides. And then they have every Tuesday night, they have a show where they play for 3 hours. So and it's hilarious. And the time really flew. Like that's another thing. If you'd asked me, would you be up for a 6 hour gaming session spread over two nights? My initial reaction would be, oh yes, that just warms my introvert soul. But then I watched a couple of their episodes and I'm like, well, first of all, 3 hours goes really fast when you're having fun. And second, this looks like it's really fun, and it was. So that was neat.
So what were some of your favorite experiences along the way? The, you know, as far as guests or moments or doing the book readings or whatever.
I mean, part of this year has just been experimenting with all of these different virtual technologies, and Zoom has turned out to be the most useful, I think, because it's got the lowest overhead. You just need the computer and a microphone and a headset. But I have to say I was most fascinated by the experiences of going into VR settings where I got to take on a different body and an avatar. And the problem is that, yeah, the technology isn't quite there yet. It's good enough to have an amazing experience, but it's not good enough to have an amazing experience easily.
Yes.
I'm waiting for like two or three more generations of the technology when the glasses, the headset does not weigh more than my, maybe a little more than my current, eyeglasses, but it has to be something where I can slip it on and 30 seconds later I'm in there rather than, okay, I've got to get the big headset out and then, fortunately, I've got the customized lenses, so I don't have to actually wear my eyeglasses underneath the goggles. But that was the thing. I had these specialized inserts made in Poland that were shipped to me that duplicated my, and they're not expensive, but it's just like,
yeah,
that's the thing is like, apparently there's no software solution for that. So you get the goggles, and if you're nearsighted, you will be nearsighted in virtual reality. So you've either got to wear your eyeglasses, which if they have big frames is going to be an issue, or you get these customized inserts, which work great, but then you're the only person who can use your headset because it will screw up anybody else, just like somebody else trying to wear your glasses. So, there is the boot up factor where the first headset I was using, the first Oculus headset, required me to plug it in and then boot up the software. So it takes probably 3-4 minutes to get rolling. And that's just not good enough yet. I want to be able to it's like, it should take me 30 seconds to a minute to get into the game tops. Mm-hmm. And there are other things. So, but once you're in there, once you're in the realm, the illusion is amazing. And especially being with other people in a group setting.
Yeah.
And the fact that it collapses the distance, like you can have, I'm here, somebody else is in Munich, and you're having a conversation like you're in the room together. It's just, that part of it is so convenient because, yeah, you don't have to fly overnight somewhere and find a hotel and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's got a lot of potential. And
yeah, for sure. And I remember when I was present for the Altspace VR reading, and I was in a Vita, avatar, but I didn't have the VR glasses or anything like that. I was just doing it on a PC. And I think if I'd not had Daryl or you in that space, I would have been stuck in the little landing spot that you enter into the space. I would never would have found my way actually to the auditorium where you did your reading. So
of course, yeah, I didn't use the goggles for the reading either because I would have been able to see my book, but
oh man, yeah, no doubt.
It was good that there was a 2D option there, and I'm glad that Altspace has that. And apparently they've upgraded it since I was last in there, because I was looking around for my reading for next week, and yeah, the avatars are spiffier now.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I think, yeah, that Microsoft has upped the software or something. But all of this stuff, they're still figuring out how to make it work. And I think this is another thing that will probably come out of the pandemic that I wrote about in my last wrap-up essay, that there's all these people at home with nothing to do, messing around with this stuff. Mm-hmm. And some of them are saying to themselves, this is cool, but there's the things we could do to make it even better. And it will be probably another 5-10 years before that, all that stuff sort of comes to fruition, but we'll probably speed up the technological advancement at least a little bit.
Yeah. We're just waiting on the next Jobs and Gates and Wozniaks and,
Yeah. But the other thing about this experience has just been, every time I think I've figured out, I've got the gist of everything you can do with this, somebody will come on the show and mention something that I had not thought of before. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. That's actually a really cool idea. With Dr. Chang, when he was talking about just the idea of, yes, that one of the reasons it's great to be able to use VR simulation with infant care is because the first time you intubate a real baby, it's a traumatic experience for everybody. And that's particularly if the parents are in the room with you. So just to be able to practice that, multiple times before you actually have to do it for real is a really useful thing to be able to do. And the more realistic it is, the better, obviously. So,
yeah, I think that was part of the reason kind of a through line in all of our talks to some extent is this idea that person to person is still largely preferable for most things. Mm-hmm. But if you can find technology and use it in a way to amplify or make it easier for those connections to happen, then it's going in the right direction. And I feel like even with Chang, he was saying, yes, like ultimately it's better to actually work in person, you know, with, you know, items that you can actually touch and feel and things like that. But ultimately, if this helps people save lives, then we need to utilize it so we can become better doctors and on some level better people. And so, yeah, I just like the idea that it's not about replacing people. It's about making those connections happen easier than what they may in a normal circumstance.
And then there's, we have a written interview coming up with Karen Maliki Sanchez, who's this Canadian Renaissance man.
Yeah, no kidding.
And again, it's like I'm reading his answers to our questions, his incredibly thorough answers to these questions we gave him. And again, I'm like, wow, you're just dropping all of the stuff that I had not even considered yet. And so,
yeah.
So every time I think I get to the bottom of it, there's more there, which is great.
And that also kind of opens up the idea that, you know, there's just a lot of potential for this technology. There's a lot of spaces. And the other thing was just recognizing the blind sides or the blind spots that we have as a culture, because we were talking about people who are blind or hard of hearing or just this idea that, like, how does one do VR or AR in those spaces? Like, how do we make it accessible to them? And I think those are really, like, those are just things I, you know, don't think about. Like, I'm thinking about all these, like, big ethical questions of, like, you know, what if the government gets it? Or, you know, and at the end of the day, like, really, it's the bigger question is probably going to be, like, accessibility. Like, how can people of all different walks of life and all different backgrounds and challenges and economic statuses, whatever it may be, how can they access this technology to benefit themselves?
There are answers to those questions. Yeah. It's just, you've got to have people who are willing to ask them. And, you know, we have had guests who've gone out of their way to mention this, which is great. There are people in the field who are thinking about it. Yeah. I mean, certainly you could worry about the government. I think the bigger worry is probably going to be more like Facebook. Like this is one of the things that happened this past year. And I keep going back to Noah Nelson, but he mentioned this also recently in one of his podcasts was that one of the big things that happened this year is that previously the Oculus headset had been owned by Facebook, but it was sort of this independent project. And now they did this thing last year where right around the time the Oculus Quest 2 was about to come out, where they said, well, now you're going to have to link your Oculus account to your Facebook account if you want to continue. And like, if you don't do that, you can continue to use your headset, but eventually it will not be as useful.
Yeah.
So basically they're just put a gun to your head and say, if you want to continue using this, you know, and right now the Oculus really is the go-to headset if you're a gamer. And it's like, so if you want to continue using this, you know, premier gamer headset, you're basically going to have to let Facebook have your data. And that just made me think about like they've got this new thing with the software now where if you want to try it, it's still experimental, but where you can put down the hand controllers and it can actually just see your fingers and you can use hand gestures to do most of the things you would want. Which is really cool, but as Cory Doctorow would probably point out, they're capturing all of this data and biometric data on you. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not going to use it for anything nefarious right now, they're going to use what they learn from that to come up with new technologies that they probably can do really nefarious things with. So it's interesting stuff. So there's good sides and bad sides to it.
Of course. But, yeah, and that's the case with any technology. I mean, all you have to do is do a little history searching and find out when the radio came on the scene, what were the positive and negative outcomes of that? I mean, they were there. Mm-hmm. we look back on it fondly because we're like, oh, radio, that's quaint. Yeah. So, but there were some seismic shifts that happened with each kind of movement of technology. And so,
it's,
and a lot of, I think the most interesting part about technology is that the people who are in the midst of kind of that development don't always see the positive, or all of the positive or all of the negative in the moment. We look back on it and say, oh yeah, that's probably not the best thing that could have happened. So,
I mean, my standard reaction to stuff like this, and this is why I could probably never be a political activist, is I just generally, my first question is not what can we do about this, but is this something I actually have any control over whatsoever, or is the technology just coming? And if the answer is it's just coming, then my attitude immediately shifts to, okay, how do I adapt to the new world this is going to bring in personally, rather than how do I fight this?
Well, no,
there are people who try to stand up and at least mm-hmm. make better things happen. But I think unless you're working in the industry, it's really difficult to do that in a way that that's, of course, one of the themes of the novel is that it's really hard to get people to do what you want them to do, especially when they have more mm-hmm. power than you do. So you've got to,
Well, and no individual can cause systemic change. It takes a lot of people with a similar push. And so I think you're right. And in recognizing that element is recognizing that sometimes we can't change the world. We can't fix the problem. So how do we adapt to negate any of the negative things that we see on the pike, down the pike? So I think you're right about that for sure. That speaks to my skeptical heart. Thank you.
it's been good having you sort of the counterpoint on this, because otherwise, it's tempting for me to just be like, oh, this stuff's really cool. And this thing's bad, but I can get some good drama out of it. So I don't
care. Well, and I'm generally the cynical type anyways. I always see glass half empty. So I think the big question to kind of wind down our discussion, my big question for you was, of all the interviews, of all the ideas that we've kind of come up against, has there been anything that has really like seismically shifted the way you viewed this technology or technology in general? Just any kind of seismic shift that you felt in the midst of making this podcast?
I can't probably speak to a specific moment, but again, I just think the thing that struck me, it just continues to strike me, is the versatility. It's sort of like, you know, trying to figure out what the effect of computers. I mean, that's the only thing I can really compare it to, because that's a technological change I've lived through, where, you know, computers existed already when I was born, but the era of the PC was, you know, still a little bit in the future. And so having seen that come in, and it's funny, it's of course, because this is me, I'm a game player. Like, originally computers were just a cool way to do games, and partly because there were these clunky boxes that didn't really have a lot of power to do much else other than boring stuff like accounting, which I had no interest in as a teenager. And then, you know, as they became more powerful and more ubiquitous, they just ended up doing things that it just would never have occurred to me in the early days what they could do. And I guess that's the thing, is like, initially, if you would ask me, is it possible that VR is just one of those things it's a gimmick that's not going to go anywhere, I would have at least acknowledged that is a possibility. That it's, because again, partly because it's been teased for, like, pretty much from the dawn of the PC era, they've been like, oh yeah, and pretty soon we're going to be able to put on goggles and go anywhere. And then, you know, you got, like that dreadful movie, The Lawnmower Man. Took a totally unrelated Stephen King story and came up with a reason, you know, as a reason to just do some computer graphics.
It made the greatest film ever made.
But now I'm like, no, this is coming, and it's going to be a big deal. The only question is, you know, am I still going to be alive, and, you know, will I still know my own name by the time it becomes as ubiquitous and powerful as computer technology is now? And I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's probably still going to be another 10, 20 years before it really takes off and gets convenient enough that anyone can use it. And part of that too is just going to be, because right now, if you're our age, unless you're already inclined to really love tech stuff, this is not something that a casual user is just going to pick up. But we're going to get to that point where you know, somebody is going to come in, like, yes, the Apple is going to decide, okay, now it's time for us to do the Macintosh version of VR that, you know, everyone is going to love.
It's super light and super sleek and, you know, it comes great in all these different colors.
And, you know, has proprietary problems.
Exactly.
But you're willing to put up with them because it's so cool.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, I think that's the biggest thing, is that now I know it's not just a cool gimmick that doesn't, that in, and to the extent that it may still appear that way, it's just because the technology is still baking.
Yeah.
It's not.
Well, and to tell you the honest truth, you were saying that you came into the podcast saying that you would have at least given credence to the idea that it was a gimmick and that it was going to fall by the wayside. That is exactly what I thought going into this podcast, is that I ultimately have always had in my head this idea of VR being this basically nothing more than, you know, William Castle's shock seats in the movie theaters. Like, it's going to be big for a while. It's going to be an event, but then it's just going to fizzle away and never be seen again. And so,
then you start talking to the artists who know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Like Brandon Oldenburg. And I remember, that's the other thing is, like, when I first got my Oculus, I was really excited for like a week. Mm-hmm. And then I realized there's really only like three or four different types of game on this.
Yeah.
And after you played one shooter, you pretty much played them all. It's just a question of, you know, but then I think it's called Manifest 99, was this interactive story that Brandon did, and messing around with that, I was like, okay, this is something I haven't seen before, and it's still hobbled somewhat by the technology.
Yeah.
But if people can figure out a way to do something like this that moves me in this way, then mm-hmm. then Once the tech gets better and easier to use and easier to put on, I think this is going to be a big deal. And then, we met Noah, we met Sasha, and you know, and just all of these different uses. And then, of course, Karim, who's got a million ideas about what you can do with this.
So. Which you will our audience had probably read by the time this will come out. I think this will be actually the last thing that pops down on the feed. There will be two or three interviews that happen before this drops. So, yeah, they will be enlightened by Karim for sure. Because as I was reading the interview, I was like, wow, this guy actually took some time to write this out.
I know. I was really astonished, because I was worried we'd given him too many questions and we get back like 9-10 pages, but it's really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And again, it's like, I suppose the guy runs two different virtual reality conferences, so it makes sense he would know a lot of the stuff, but still, I was just like, wow, okay.
It sounded like he was super excited about the topic. And so whenever you're super excited about that kind of topic, it's super easy to write those kind of answers.
And he's also somebody who cares about the, you know, making sure this stuff doesn't get misused, mm-hmm. whether he's actually got the power to do any good I don't know. Yeah. But if it's you versus Facebook, I don't know who I'd bet on there. But
exactly.
But yeah. It's just a reminder, there really are people who were thinking about this, probably because they've seen what happened with the last go around with social mm-hmm. media and how that went wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's been the thing, though, is just being really impressed with, there's a lot here. And mm-hmm. I've kind of said my own piece with this novel, but if I'm sure there are versions of this technology that I could do other things with and other mm-hmm. stories. So there's more to look at. And I'm particularly interested, once it's possible to go out in public again to just try some of the live immersive stuff. Like,
I would love to do that too. That sounds so amazing.
Yeah. Like, even an escape room, I think, mm-hmm. sounds goofy, but I actually think that might be a lot of fun. And there are some here in Seattle. So my goofy question for you, which you kind of already partially answered, was, you are the technology skeptic of the podcast. And so I wanted to know of the many VR and facets of VR and AR that we've discussed with our guests, was there one particular application that sort of pierced your cynical heart?
The most of all.
Made you say, gee, this is a great use of technology that I can get behind. And on the flip side, you know, is there something that made you think, wow, this is worse than I imagined? And so take those in whatever order you want.
So whenever I asked, I'll take the negative first, because I want to end on a positive note.
I knew you would think about
that. I think most of my concerns around the potential negatives of this technology were pretty much summed up mostly in Michael Medary. I thought he brought up a lot of the concerns I would have, generally speaking, but I also recognize that while I don't want to, you know, short shrift his argument and say that this isn't going to happen for a long time, I also recognize that we're quite a ways off from the kind of the darker potentials of the technology. But that being said, they're still possible. And I still think there's validity to having a code of ethics for technology. So that's just kind of a big abstract thing. So I'll push that to the side and say that if you want to hear some of my concerns, just go back to the Medary episode and you would have a pretty good summation. I think for me, the biggest potential was actually with Brandon Oldenburg, I believe. And he's the one who was talking about the ability, just recognizing the ability to take this technology and transport someone that, let's say, has never been out of the country and transport them to a refugee camp in a war-torn country in a way that is showing real people, the real impact of war in these places, and making it personal, making it something that feels real to someone who just doesn't pay attention or isn't mindful of these, you know, worldwide events. That actually has a lot of potential in my mind to be beneficial. If nothing else, just basically using VR as an empathy machine. And not saying that's going to necessarily change minds. Once again, I'm still cynical, but I recognize that nothing, very little of what we've done so far has worked. So if there's things we can try with this technology to kind of bring people out of their bubbles, their echo chambers, and help them see humanity across the world, I think it's a positive. There's very little negative going on there. And so I think that's beneficial. Like War Remains, the program that they did, where they're basically putting you in the midst of, you know, the trenches of World War One. It was World War One, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I was momentary.
Yeah, World War One was the trenches. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just experience, like the idea of experiencing that's something I would want to experience. Like that's because I'm a history major at heart, and that's what I got my master's in. So being able to live in some version of history is compelling to me, because reading words on a page and no matter how good a teacher might be, it's not real.
Yeah.
And so actually being placed in a world in which, like, you know, auditory, sensory, all these things are kind of going off around you. You're feeling the bombs, you know, falling around you. You're walking through this trench. Like, you're going to be shaken on some level, because you can't just go through that and just not have any effect whatsoever. So, yeah, I think those are the things that I find most compelling. And it's pretty much whatever in the technology can make the most human impact. I think that's what I'm most interested in. I'm interested in how to connect humanity. So
I am too, and I somewhat, I mean, I come at it from a slightly different angle, but this is definitely one of the themes of the novel for me. It was just this idea that the answer, what are they thinking?
Yeah.
The question, what are they thinking, has an answer. And empathy actually can work. And even with a veil of technology between you and all the powers of deception that something like VR could bring to bear, it is possible, if you really want to understand other people, even if they're very different from you, there are ways to do that. And yeah, technology can make that more difficult, but it can also make it easier. And the tricky part is always going to be getting people to want to empathize.
Yeah.
Because there is this part of us when we encounter somebody who, you know, has an opinion, a heterodox opinion or something, or they're just voted for the other guy, or you want to fall back on the old thing. Well, either they're stupid, they're crazy, or they're evil.
Yeah.
And I don't need to know anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to find a way to get past that and say, well, no, there's the fourth answer, which is just they're not you.
Yeah.
And they're coming at this from a different angle, but it doesn't mean that they're irredeemably evil or that they're nuts. It's just that they're thinking about it a different way than you do. But that doesn't mean you can't understand that at least well enough to come up with a more intelligent way to deal with them than just being mad. And yeah, this is something that certainly the VR experience can help with, I guess, although I think it's going to take clever people to figure out ways to make you take that first step to want to go there and understand.
Yeah, for sure.
And
I think, I mean, it's the issue of, I mean, social media, for all of its positives, like it has created a vacuum of your own personal, you know, chamber people who agree with you and are not challenging your opinion or doing all these things. And so part of me is like, is there a way that we can, like, you know, bust that open a little bit to where we're recognizing that even people that we think are horrid with these horrid opinions have their own personal histories and they were led to this place. So yeah, it's like you said, empathy does wonders if you're in the right mindset and you have the right kind of,
you gotta want to do it.
Exactly. Because it doesn't always work if you're going into it hard-hearted. So
yeah. And I think that's a nice note to end on, probably.
I think so too.
I just want to say a few quick thank yous to our man behind the scenes, Daryl A. Armstrong.
Yes.
He's just been incredible throughout this whole thing. And Threaded Zebra Agency, Rise Up Daily, who hosts the podcast, our many wonderful guests, our sponsors. And I'm looking at you, HyperX Quadcast, glowy microphone. And you know, last but not least, man. you, Blake, you've been an amazing co-host, and it's been a lot of fun to do this with you. So I'm just so glad you suggested it, and I'm very glad I said yes. So
I'm glad you said yes too, and I'm glad that we've gotten to know each other as well as we have. It's been a blast for me, and I'd like to thank you for taking me up on this and going on the ride. It's been really fun.
So we will meet in person at some point when it's possible to do so.
So well, with that, we will say goodbye for 88 Names Podcast. It's been a blast.
Until we hear from David Cronenberg.
Exactly. David, if you're listening, give us a call.
We'll come back for you. But yeah, otherwise, yes, we will. Thanks everyone for joining us in virtual oral reality. A-U-R-A-L reality.
Nice. Man, I don't think I could have done that on fly. That's really good.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
That's right.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.